most of the foods and beverages that we describe as fermented meet the biologist's definition. They are anaerobic. You know, when we turn, you know, this bowl of cabbage and other vegetables into sauerkraut, that's an anaerobic process that does not require oxygen. When we take milk and ferment it into yogurt, that's an anaerobic process that does not require oxygen. When we take grape juice and ferment it into wine, that's an anaerobic process that does not require oxygen. The reason why I typically depart from the biologist's definition of fermentation is that there are a large handful of microbially transformed foods and beverages that do require oxygen. So, if any of you like to drink kombucha, a kombucha is an example of an aerobic ferment. Call it an oxymoronic ferment. Because it's a microbial transformation that requires oxygen, but like everybody thinks of it as fermented. Similarly, vinegar requires oxygen. Similarly, many types of cheese require oxygen. The Indonesian soy ferment tofu, tempeh requires oxygen. So, because there are all of these microbially transformed foods that, don't meet the biologist's definition of fermentation, I like to work with this broader lay definition that fermentation is the transformative action of microorganisms. However, not every transformative action of microorganisms results in something delicious that we're ready to put into our mouths. For most people, our primary awareness of the microbial transformation of food comes when we clean the refrigerator. In the deep recesses of the refrigerator, you find decomposed vegetables and, things that have begun to mold. And that's also the transformative action of microorganisms, but we don't call that fermenting. We have a different vocabulary to describe that. We call that rotten. We call that spoiled. And we reserve the word fermentation to describe intentional or desirable microbial transformation. But I think the fact that we all inevitably experience food decomposition maybe can give us some insight into the now, in terms of science and cooking, one of the things that's most fascinating to me about fermentation is that people have been practicing this for 10,000 years. I would argue longer. The archaeological record of this finding is it's telling us about the history of pottery, and that's when pottery, earlier vessels, were biodegradable, so we're not finding the means of it. But anyway, that's but the people who figured out fermentation techniques, they didn't have the benefit of microbiology. They didn't know about microorganisms. What we now understand is that all of the plants and all of the animal products that make up our food are populated by these elaborate communities of microorganisms. So, the question is, are these microorganisms going to decompose our food into something disgusting and heavy into their mouths? Are these microorganisms going to create toxic byproducts or make us sick? Or are these microorganisms going to somehow elevate the food and make it more delicious, more stable, more digestible, or improve the food in some way? And without knowing about the existence of microorganisms, people in every part of the world figured out, through observation, through trial and error, through happy accidents, who knows how to think about how to guide the microbial transformation of the food. And really what the practice of fermentation amounts to are manipulations of environmental conditions that determine, which of the multitude of organisms that are present on anything that makes up our food are going to develop and in what way they will be transformed. So, a head of cabbage. I'll be referring to this repeatedly through the evening, but if we just left a bowl of cabbage like this sitting on the counter for 2 weeks or 2 months, it is not going to turn itself into sauerkraut. And it's really quite predictable what's going to happen. And, you know, some of us have seen the early stages of this. Like maybe you had a piece of cabbage like this left over from something you cooked. And, let's just say there was no room in your fermentation slowing device, your refrigerator. You left it on the counter. And you didn't get back to it the next day, and it sat there for a few days. Has anyone ever seen like a little film of mold develop on those cut surfaces? And you can still use the cabbage, you just slice those away. But you know, where the carbohydrates are oozing out in the presence of oxygen, mold is going to grow. So it's possible to have a bowl of cabbage turn into like, you know, a cloud of seeds. It's possible to have a bowl of shredded cabbage turn into, you know, a kind of a cloud of mold that could literally reduce that cabbage into a puddle of slime that bears no resemblance to delicious, tangy, crunchy sauerkraut. Not to scare anyone about eating cabbages or other raw vegetables, but you know, the bacteria that produces the scariest food poisoning pathogen that we know of, Clostridium botulinum, which produces a toxin called botulism. It's such a common soil bacteria that probably none of us have ever eaten a vegetable in our lives that didn't have cells of Clostridium botulinum. But we really only ever hear about botulism in the context of canning. So if you if you sterilize food in a jar in order to preserve it, but you fail to use adequate heat, Clostridium botulinum can survive higher than boiling temperatures. So what you do is you sort of kill everything else and leave that as the sole survivor in the very contrived environment where it can thrive, which is a totally oxygen, in the total absence of oxygen. It's an obligate anaerobic. It can only function in the absence of oxygen. And we don't really spend much of our time in a totally anaerobic environment. So, you know, when you chop up cabbage to make a coleslaw, broadly ferment into sauerkraut, or to make a stir fry, you don't have to
broadly speaking ferment.
It's only if
broadly speaking, fermentation is the transformative action of fermentation is the transformative action of broadly speaking, fermentation is the transformative action of microorganisms.
And you know, which of the microbes that are on it are going to develop is entirely an environmental question. So fermentation is all about manipulating environments to encourage the growth of certain kinds of organisms while simultaneously discouraging the growth of other kinds of organisms. So, I mean, what we'll be doing eventually with this bowl of cabbage is we're going to get the vegetables submerged under their own juices, and that just protects them from the free flow of oxygen so the molds can't grow. It's not totally anaerobic. I mean, there's dissolved oxygen in the water so the Clostridium botulinum can't grow, and in that sort of protected environment, the lactic acid bacteria, which are generally believed to be present on all plants growing out of soil on planet Earth, they can thrive and flourish. And as they acidify the environment, they kill off most of the other organisms that are present. And that's really what that's part of what enables the food to be so effectively preserved. So fermentation is the transformative action of microorganisms. There is no food that cannot be fermented. It doesn't mean every food has, you know, equally prominent traditions of fermentation. A couple of avocados are like an example of a food that, like, I don't think that there's much tradition of fermenting, but I've put avocado in sauerkraut and it works great. Nothing that we could possibly eat could not be fermented. And then, you know, a related issue is fermentation is practiced everywhere. I definitely do not possess encyclopedic knowledge of culinary traditions, everywhere in the world. But I've been looking really hard for counterexamples for, more than 20 years. And I can't, every time someone has proposed, like, a part of the world where they believe that fermentation is not practiced, I've been able to, learn about fermented food or conceptually possible for hunter-gatherer people to live without fermentation. If you're going to spend each day procuring the food resources that you're going to get through that day, you don't really have to think too much about the dynamics of how food fares over time. But, you know, as people in different parts of the world transition from hunter-gatherer societies into agricultural societies, if you're going to invest your energy and your resources into crops that are ready at a certain moment of the year, then that is only feasible as a strategy for survival if you have some strategies in mind for how you're going to preserve the harvest to get you through the rest of the year. So, you know, I would argue that agriculture itself would not be possible without fermentation. It's not that fermentation is the only ancient method of preservation, but most of the ways that we preserve food today, you know, just haven't existed in the past. I mean, okay, we can't even imagine how you live without a refrigerator. Right? If we were sitting here just 100 years ago, you know, nobody would have a refrigerator. And, you know, bear in mind that most households on planet Earth in 2017 do not have a refrigerator. Refrigeration is not universally available. And so, you know, people use other techniques for preserving food. You know, then we might think about canning. Some of us might have, think of canning as an old-time preservation technique because, you know, we mostly associate with a grandparent or great-grandparent or something like that. Canning is a 200-year-old technology. It was patented in France in 1812, where it's called apertization, because they remember the name of Nicolas Appert, the clever Frenchman who, invented the process of sterilizing food in a jar. So if you take away refrigerators and freezers and canning, there aren't that many other methods of preservation. There's drying food. Drying food preserves food, basically by depriving the microorganisms that are on the food of the water that they need in order to function. So, dried foods are not, sterilized in the way that canned foods are. The microbes are present, but they're in a state of dormancy because they lack the water that they need in order to function. You know, certain foods are just dry when they're mature. That's their nature. Like any kind of grain, any kind of bean, any kind of nut. They're just dry when they're mature. Other foods can be dried, like fish or meat or fruit or vegetables. Really any food could be dry. And then beyond that, fermentation has been just a major way that people have preserved food. Sauerkraut, kimchi, pickles, these are all strategies for people in temperate parts of the world to preserve vegetables from, the limited season when they can be formative to action of the rest organisms. Of the fermentation is the transformative action. Simply speaking, fermentation is the transformative action. Simply speaking, fermentation is the transformative action of microorganisms. All that, but I mean, really, what cheese is preserved milk. Cheese and yogurt. And kefir and other forms of fermented milk really are strategies for extending the life of this, or the usefulness of this, extremely perishable food. Salami, you walk into a delicatessen and the salami is just like hanging from a string in the ceiling. I mean, that's preserved meat. It's a, you take this, this animal that, you've been feeding for months and, weighs 300 pounds and you can't eat it all at one sitting. So you have to have strategies to preserve the meat so you can eat it over a longer period of time. And that's what all cured meats are. So preservation has been just an incredibly, incredibly important reason why people ferment. I wish I could say that I got interested in fermentation for something as high-minded as that, but what first made me start thinking about fermentation was the flavors of fermentation. Fermentation creates compelling flavors. If you walk into a gourmet food store anywhere, most of what you're going to see and smell are products of fermentation. Most of the world's greatest delicacies are products of fermentation. Fermentation creates strong flavors. Of course, with strong flavors, not everybody loves everything. You know, cheese illustrates this so well. So, as my taste has evolved, and I wasn't born like this, but like, I love stinky, stinky cheese. You know, if I can smell it from, you know, hundreds of feet away, it just catches my attention, and I'm dying to try it. And I'm so sure not everyone in here would share my passion for stinky cheeses. And, you know, whenever I have a really sort of very ripe, stinky piece of cheese, and I invite some friends over to share it with me, you know, inevitably somebody gets to the door and just makes this awful face, and they're thinking, did something die in here? And like, they would never ever think about putting something that smelled like that into their mouths. And you know, the world of fermentation is just full of these, you know, strong flavors. You know, they're what we would call acquired taste. Like, you're not born loving a stinky cheese. You're not born loving Surströmming, the, you know, Swedish low-salt fermented herring. Just the stronger flavors of fermentation people learn to like through exposure, through seeing other people get excited about them, through being willing to taste them a second and a third time. So, flavor's a very important aspect of fermentation. What's getting a lot of people interested in fermentation at the present moment is perceived health benefits. So I want to just address that a little bit. It's not like all of these foods have precisely the same qualities. It's not like, you know, coffee and bread and cheese and kimchi, are all the same. Like, they're all different. They're all based on different foods that have different qualities. The fermentations are different. You know, every food is unique. But the process of fermentation transforms nutrients in some very clear patterns of ways. The first way Pia referred to in her introduction, and that is what I would call pre-digestion. The idea that, you know, while the food is fermenting, you know, the bacteria or the fungi that are fermenting it are breaking down nutrients into more elemental forms. Frequently, these simpler forms are easier for us to access. I would say the most dramatic example of this is, the reason why the vegetarian subcultures just became so interested in soybeans and they became almost a singular replacement for meat and milk is that soybeans are considered to be the plant food with the most concentrated protein. I really never heard about people just eating a plate of soybeans for dinner. I've read lentils or chickpeas. The reason for this is that our human digestive systems are not capable of breaking down the protein in soybeans. And, they'll kill you if you eat a plate of soybeans for dinner. It will make you really gassy. It'll give you terrible indigestion. And you're not going to get the protein out of the soybeans. Somehow, thousands of years ago, the Asian cultures that pioneered soy agriculture recognized the digestibility of the soybeans and figured out how to make soybeans digestible. We have this whole range of fermented soy foods. There's soy sauce, there's miso, there's tempeh, there's napo, there's dozens of other variations. The four that I mentioned are very different in flavor, they're different in texture, they're different in fermentation processes, they're different in the organisms that ferment them. But what they all have in common is that protein gets broken down into amino acids, the building blocks of protein. Similarly, when you ferment milk, lactose, the milk sugar that so many people have a hard time digesting, breaks down. And many people who can't drink a glass of milk have a fine time eating yogurt. But of course, it's not a question of yes or no. It's a matter of degree. And, most commercial yogurt that's available, the assumption, at least in the United States, is that people, want their yogurt minimally sour. And so, most commercial yogurt in the United States is fermented for about 2.5 hours, which is enough to just set the yogurt, but without making it too sour. But what the sourness is lactic acid, and that's what the lactose is being transformed into. So the more sour it is, the less lactose there is. So you can make yogurt yourself at home. Instead of fermenting it for 2.5 hours, you can ferment it for 8 hours. You can ferment it for 12 hours. You can ferment it for 24 hours. And you'll have a different product. It'll be more sour, but it'll be less lactose too. That's three dozens. Even the, you know, the notorious wheat protein. Go to any store and buy. Yeast has been present with us, forever. And people have been making bread for, you know, something like 10,000 years. And so when Pasteur isolated yeast in the 19th century, yeast was never alone. Yeast has always been used with the bacteria that it travels with. So, you know, on the wheat itself, like on grapes or barley. There, but it's not alone. It's with lactic acid bacteria. So what we now call sourdough, which is natural leavening, which is really how bread down toxic compounds. So there's all kinds of toxic compounds in different kinds of plants that fermentation can break down. And some of them are dramatic, like cyanide in cassava. You know, cassava in certain parts of the world grows with these extraordinarily high levels of cyanide. And if people were to eat unprocessed cassava roots, they would literally kill them. And yet it's this, you know, very important sorts of nutrients for about 1 billion people around the equatorial regions of the world. And so in the parts of the world where cassava grows with high levels of cyanide, one of the major strategies for removing the cyanide is fermentation. It's very simple. Like, you peel it, you pour some chocolate, put it in a vessel filled with water, that initiates a fermentation, and it melts down the cyanide compounds. A lot of people are not quite as dramatic as that. Salic acid is kind of added to all of those people. Then I'm going to But it's actually incredibly delicious. And in that slimy cream that develops from the absorbing of microbes, you can get new vitamins that are exposed to the everything we eat has its own microbiome. And yet we're still in this war on bacteria mentality. And we all have chemical exposure to compounds that are designed to kill bacteria. Whether it's antibiotic drugs, whether it's antibiotic cleansing products, whether it's chlorine in all of our municipal water systems. But we all have exposure every day to these compounds. Luckily, none of them are terrible. But what they do is they diminish biodiversity. And we think a lot about biodiversity in terms of, the oceans and the rainforest. But biodiversity is a concept that, applies inside our bodies as well. As we learn about the incredible range of our functionality that involves bacteria, we're also learning ways in which we are hurting ourselves through this chemical exposure that diminishes our biodiversity. Bacteria in our bodies do way more than enable us to digest food. I mean, that's a very important thing, that bacteria enable us to effectively digest food and assimilate nutrients from that food. Our immune systems are largely the work of bacteria in our intestines. In the last few years, there's been incredible groundbreaking work demonstrating that serotonin and other compounds that determine our neurological function, how we think, how we feel, are regulated by bacteria in our intestines. And it turns out that nearly every process in our bodies involves these bacteria, and yet we and so this has given rise to what is called probiotics, the antidote to antibiotics to ingest bacteria. There's a huge industry of capsules that you can buy, probiotics. This is saying, this is a billion cells in this capsule. Well, it's a billion copies of three different bacteria, which has limited impact on biodiversity. The contrast to that would be traditional fermented foods, none of which involve singular bacteria. They all involve these elaborate communities of bacteria. So when we ingest living fermented foods, we are promoting biodiversity in our gut. We don't really understand it at all. There's some elaborate interaction between the bacteria you ingest and the bacteria residents on earliest articulations of the idea of probiotics, Eli Metchnikoff, writing 10 years ago. His vision of it was the petri dish and the bacteria of the yogurt just take over the intestine and make everything better. It's a highly competitive environment. It's not like the bacteria in residence in our intestines just kind of move over and make room for the new bacteria in the yogurt to take up residence. But there is an elaborate interaction, and part of that interaction is a genetic interaction. And one of the most fascinating things about bacteria is their genetic flexibility. So in contrast to us and animals and plants and fungi, which all have fixed genetics for the course of our lives, bacteria aren't constrained in that way. Bacteria are extremely genetically flexible. They can exchange genetic information. They can pick up genetic information from the environment. They can get rid of genetic information. It's no longer relevant to their existence. Part of that interaction is a genetic all of that said, I think that fermented foods are very important. I think there's also a lot of unsubstantiated hype. There are websites telling people that if they drink kombucha every day, their diabetes will go away, your hair will never get gray, you'll reverse aging. I mean, there's a lot of ridiculous things that people are saying. But I think that the underlying idea that there is great potential when we ingest bacterially rich food to improve digestion, improve immune function, potentially improve mental health and other systems of the body without any risk, is significant. Okay, now let me talk a little bit about some fermentation concepts. So the first book that I wrote about fermentation, my books are up there, I'm going to do a little book signing after, was called Wild Fermentation. I didn't make up this expression. It's found throughout the literature and it describes what I'm specific. Wild fermentation is fermentation that is based on the organisms that are present on the food. Nobody uses starters to make sauerkraut because people are selling starters to make sauerkraut. But, it's totally unnecessary. Singular microorganisms is they are sort of brand new. There are new seeds and technologies. Iceland or Egypt. Incredible range of star groups are available, but they're new. The ancient form of stone is what I would describe as backslapping. And that's basically you take the old badge and you put them into the new badge. This is how people make deals. You know, the way they get rid of it is you take the old badge and you put it into a fresh batch of milk, and there's some temperature manipulation involved. And there's some nice sources of bacteria that are used to please the ones that you want. This is what a sourdough is. Generally, a sourdough is started as a wild fermentation. Really, all of those yeast and bacteria are present on the yeast, on the wheat or on any other grain. But once you have a nice vigorous sourdough with a good flavor and a good lifting action for your bread, you never get the whole thing. You always save a little bit to perpetuate, to introduce into some fresh flour and water. I've met people who have sourdoughs that are hundreds of years old, that's been passed down in their families for generations. And you can do lots of things this way. Before pure yeast was available, a lot of breweries made beer by saving a little bit of the last batch to introduce it to the next batch. This is the way a lot of traditional salami making has been done, so a little bit of an old batch to introduce it to the next batch. So that's really the ancient form of a starter. So then the third form of a starter are what we describe here as SCOBYs, S-C-O-B-Y, which is an acronym which stands for Symbiotic Communities of Bacteria and Yeast. There's really just a handful of these. The most famous example right now would be kombucha. The SCOBY is the mother of kombucha. It's like a rubbery pancake that floats on top of the sweetened tea. And that community of organisms that are part of the rubbery pancake grow into the sweet tea and digest carbohydrates and transform it into a kombucha. Another example of this would be kefir. Grains of kefir, very different appearance from kombucha. They look more like little florets of cauliflower. And embedded in those florets of cauliflower is an incredibly complex community with more than 30 distinct organisms that have been identified. But somehow coordinate their reproduction, spin the skin that they share, and ferment milk in the process. There's a handful of other ones. There's one called Tibicos, also known as water kefir, which comes from Mexico, and like little crystalline structures. And you put them in any kind of carbohydrate-rich liquid, ferment the carbohydrates into acids and alcohol, and you can make delicious beverages with them. Now, conceptually, all of these starters had to start as a wild fermentation, right? Where did the first yogurt come from? It's a little bit of a chicken or an egg.
Broadly speaking, fermentation is the transformative action of microbial organisms. Fermentation is the transformative action of microorganisms.
And somebody will realize
fermentation is the transformative
There's a lot of great documentation of different kinds of animals counting themselves on fermentation. And it just so happens that we evolved with enzymes that can digest alcohol. Alcohol is a natural phenomenon. If you ever pick a lot of berries, you'll note some of them are fermented. It's just a natural phenomenon that, our clever ancestors figured out, how to make happen. And we developed a lot of technology, like I referred to pottery earlier. We developed lots of technology to, enable ourselves to master techniques for making these foods and beverages.
Thank you. listening to Radio Ravioli. My name is Olivia. This is right now Marissa Anderson in Waves is the name of the track from the album Into the Light. From a couple of years ago, 2016. Of this, the past 45 minutes or so, there has been Sander Katz talking about fermentation and cooking sauerkraut. It's from a live lecture he did just a few months ago at Harvard. They have some crazy thing. I found it on the internet, but it looks like a cool course where they talk about physics and cooking or something. I don't know. Not that I can understand it, but it's very interesting. Actually, when they announce him, Sander Katz, the person who's the host of the program, she actually mentions pasta and relates it to the process of cooking pasta to the process of fermenting. One is with direct heat, the other is with microbes. But just points out the clear and natural relations between making radio ravioli, fermenting sounds through a radio, and being here today. I've been dreaming of fermenting my own cheese and then putting it in my own handmade dough or fresh dough for my own raviolis, and maybe somehow growing my own tomatoes for my own tomato sauce. If you have, apparently it's easy to make cheese, so if you know of a recipe, please let me know. As always, you can email me, olivia@wfmu.org.
If you are unaware, it is WGXC's Radio Magic Pledge Drive. For 2 weeks, we ask our listeners, you, to donate and help support independent, creative, community-driven radio. You can donate at wgxc.org/donate or call in 518-697-7400. It's great to be broadcasting Radio Ravioli every week, every Saturday afternoon on Wavefarm and WGXC. I love the idea of crazy, adventurous, and deconstructing radio, piercing through the beautiful landscape of Columbia and Greene counties. It's radio that you can't get anywhere else on your dial, so please pledge your support, wgxc.org/donate, or call in 518-697-7400. Again, wgxc.org/donate or 518-697-7400.
Thank you.
because we're using salt as we cultivate bacteria or reducing acids. And a good salt and acid while stainless steel theoretically resists corrosion, it turns out that household grade stainless steel just is a pretty good stainless.
Thank you. Francisco.